Hello, fellow pushers. Welcome to Pushing Cardboard. I'm Grant Lindeberg, and this is episode 28, Sam London and a Trip to Gazala. Sam is a new designer with a bunch of projects on the go. The most notable is Firefight Tactical, now on the P500 list at GMT. And as for Gazala, well, I've been recently playing Gazala the Cauldron from Roger Miller and Revolution Games, and then also Operation Theseus, Gazala 1942 from Dirk Blenheim and VUCA Simulations. Two games on the same battle. I'll take a look at how they're similar and how they differ. Lots of great feedback on the David Thompson interview. Thanks for reaching out to all of you. And thanks to everyone who also commented on my YouTube interview with Volka Runke about his new game, Coast Watchers. You can find that on my YouTube channel. I now have another YouTube interview posted, this one with Mike Ranella. We talk about his design history, his obsession with area movement games, and his new solitaire designs. As always, I'll have links to both of these things in the show notes and in the newsletter. News. As I mentioned earlier, I did an interview recently with Mike Ranella as part of the San Diego HISCON online conference, and we did a deep dive into his games. I've played at least 10 of his designs and own a couple more that I haven't got to yet. So we talked about all of those, as well as his new solo designs on Stalingrad and Manila. It was all part of San Diego's HISCON's online convention, which I hardly recommend. If you've never been to an online convention, you got to check it out. It's great. There's a lot less gameplay than in a regular convention, but there's usually tons of panels on interesting topics, designers demoing new games, and interviews like the one I did with Mike. And they're super cheap to attend. SD HISCON was $10. Armchair Dragoon's AC/DC convention was $6. So you can't go wrong. Worthington Games have a new game on Kickstarter, Louisburg 1758. It's blocks and cards and a point-to-point map. Looks to be playable in about 90 minutes. Actually, the company is old school war games, I think. But through Worthington, I'm not sure how that works. Maybe old school war games is a division of Worthington or something. But anyway, check the Worthington site, you'll find it there. Compass has a new Kickstarter as well. This is for Atlantic Sentinels, a solitaire game from Greg Smith, the solitaire master, about escorting convoys in the North Atlantic in the Second World War. I recently heard from a fellow named Andy Rourke, and he's got a new company in England called Form Square. As you might guess from the name, their first designs are on Napoleonic topics. Bonaparte's Eastern Empire is first up and can be found on GameFound, which is, if you haven't seen it yet, it works a lot like Kickstarter. It's an area map. The artwork is like old, late 19th century cartoons. They're really cool. And apparently it plays in about 2 hours, so I'm really looking forward to seeing how this one turns out. I have no idea why GMT let Unhappy King Charles go out of print. It's a terrific game, one of my favorites, and the GMT version had great graphics and components. Everything about it was terrific. Anyway, it was out of print, and apparently no plans to reprint it, so Phalanx has picked it up, and they're taking late pledges still, I think, on their version, so check it out. The new version has totally new graphics that also look amazing, and the word is there's now a solo mode, so that might convince some people to buy it a second time. I don't know. As a follow-up to my conversation with Mike Ranella, I heard that MMP is planning a reprint of his game Shifting Sands. It was Mike's first game. As he says in the interview, he was trying to make a game just like Paths of Glory. Well, he succeeded, and I don't mean that in a mean way at all. I've played Shifting Sands a few times. It's a great game, and it's the only North African game that I own that also includes East Africa, the Near East, and then all the way through that, through the torch landings in Tunisia. So a really comprehensive look at the desert in World War II. Did you ever play Ace of Aces back in the day? It was one of the most innovative games ever. It's if you haven't seen it, it's two little books, one for each player, and each page in the book and each book is a view from the cockpit of your plane looking at the other plane. There's a list of possible maneuvers on the bottom of the page with a number below each one. both players pick a maneuver and then tell each other their numbers. Then you go to that, your opponent's number page in your book, and you look at your maneuver there, and that'll give you an end page. You both go to the end page, and then you'll see the other plane from your new view. Maybe one will be firing at the other one or tailing the other one. It's a really cool way to do simultaneous movement. It's brilliant, really. Anyway, there was a whole series of books for several types of planes. They had the rotary series, the powerhouse series, some. I think there was one on balloon busting and one on maybe early war aircraft. Anyway, now they're being reprinted, and there's a Kickstarter for a campaign to launch the first set, which is the Powerhouse series. So I heartily encourage you to check it out. What's on the table this week? Well, I've been playing table battles on Rally the Troops pretty much constantly. It's such a simple game, but there's much more to it than meets the eye, and each scenario plays very differently than the previous one. I'm really hooked. My game of Not War But Murder has started back up again after a bit of a hiatus. Man, it is hard to get the Union troops across the South Anna River against a good opponent. He's blowing bridges like crazy and fortifying the spots where the bridges are intact, so I'm having a hard time getting over, but I persevere. We've just got through the in-between day section of our play of Crossing the Morrow, the historical ASL package from Lone Canuck. My Canadians are in fairly good position on day two, but a lot of my best attacks on day one came from my fighter bombers. You can only buy them twice over the 4 or 5 days that the campaign takes place, so I opted not to buy them this time. I'm going to have to hope that my OBA can take up the slack where my fighter bombers are missing. And our game of Death in the Trenches continues. I think I've mentioned this one before. There's a ton of little things in this game that I tend to forget as they're so situation specific, like every little tiny minor power or minor army. But I gotta say, it's still a compelling game. It's a bucket of dice combat system, but it's got this mechanic that allows you to push your luck a little bit, but you risk being too greedy and coming up empty. It's really fun. And then there's a giant whack of random events at the beginning and the end of each season, and those are fantastic as well. Given that'll come out in a different order each time you play, if you really get into this game, it's going to be a very different experience each time you have a go at it. New games to the collection. Well, I did get a whack of new games this time, but they were mostly used. Noble Knight had a deal on free shipping, so I grabbed some cool stuff from there. I got the Brothers in War, Brothers at War, 1862 from Compass. It's about the newest of the ones that I got in this sale. I'd heard good things about it, so I picked it up. It's got 4 battles in a single box. Looks to be fairly easy to learn and quick to play, so I look forward to that. I got a couple of oldies from Avalon Hill. Caesar, Epic Battle of Alesia. It's a kind of an old player's copy, but I've always wanted to try it. And then the same with Frederick the Great, the Campaigns of the Soldier King. I'd always heard good things about that game, and I never owned it. And then the last two were one from Colombia, Quebec, 1759, and then finally The Siege of Jerusalem. Another this was a late game from Avalon Hill. Kind of came out in that period, just before they went under. But this game, at the time, the topic totally didn't interest me at all. I just had no interest in ancients at all, and the religious angle didn't appeal to me either. But this game's got a really great reputation from what I remember, so I picked that one up. Anyway, they're all older games that I missed along the way, and I managed to get it at a good price from Noble Knight. I also got a couple of old issues of S&T that I was interested in. One has a tank, armored combat in the 20th century, and then World War I. That's a well-regarded, I think that one's a Jim Dunnigan game. And then in terms of stuff that was on order that came in, for ASL, the latest core module arrived, Twilight of the Reich, Endgame in the European Theater, 1944-45. I gotta say, I'm not sure why this is a core module. It doesn't introduce any new nationalities. It's just more late war German unit types and a few other things. Lots of scenarios and some good looking boards, I guess. But I have to say, I don't know. This was not a module I really felt good about buying. Do we need more German or American squad types? It feels like we have a million already. Anyway, then I also got a couple things from a rare sale at my local game store. My local store is a great, well-stocked store, but it doesn't often put things on clearance. So I got Antietam 1862 from Worthington. I got Paul Koenig's The Bulge, six Panzer Army from Victory Points Games. And then this one, it's so funny, Rommel's Panzers from Metagaming. It's right here. Do you remember these? Very small box, maybe 4 by 6.5 inches and a half an inch thick. Sold for $5 back in the day. Anyway, I never had this particular title, but I had others. And given my recent playing of the Gazala games, I couldn't resist this one. No books this week, but I wanted to talk about newbie tips. One of the big obstacles for new players can simply be getting started. You buy a new game, you look at the board and the pieces, then you look at the rule book and the playbook and the scenario books and whatever other books might be included, then it could all be a bit overwhelming. Everybody has their own way of dealing with all that, but I want to share mine with you. The way I do it is I like to just dive in, make mistakes, and then bash through. I'll give a skim of the rule book, reading anything that catches my eye. If the designer has notes on game mechanics, I'll check those out just to see if there's anything really different or just to know something more about the game. I look at the pieces and the player aids. I look at the first few pages of the rules to find out what the ratings on the counters mean. And then I just dive in. I pick an introductory scenario if there is one, and I start setting the game up. Often there's a section of the rules about setup, whether the game has different scenarios or just one setup. There's often a setup section, and so I read that little section, and I find that just setting out the pieces starts to give you a feel for things. And then I look at the sequence of play. This is the main thing. Look at the sequence of the play, both on the player aids and in the rule book. If there is no sequence of play, consider putting everything back in the box and setting it on the curb. But assuming you found the sequence of play, just start going through it step by step. Every time you have to do something, you look up the appropriate rules. Many games set out their rule books in the same order as the sequence of play, so that makes it easy. Others put, like, say, the movement in one section of the rules, combat in another, supply in another, and so on. But, you know, just read the bits you need to do, the step you're on, and bash through that little bit. And then, most importantly, don't worry about making mistakes. There's no need to go back and redo things or anything like that. You're not playing to see how finely balanced the game is when it's played perfectly. You're just playing to learn it at this point. If you've realized you've made an error, don't go back. Just know that the next time through, that part of the sequence won't make the same mistake again. You'll make a new mistake, and that's good. After bashing through the sequence of play a few times, you'll make less and less mistakes, and you'll find you've read more and more of the rule book. And when you're done bashing through, then it's a good time to read some of the playbook and see if you were doing things correctly, and maybe read some sections of the rule book that you may not have got to in your bash through. And then have another bash. You'll find more rules that you need to look up, but a lot of it will be understood by now. I find this going back and forth between playing and reading really speeds up my learning. I've tried reading a rule book before playing, and it just never works for me. I find myself just doing the bash and read method afterwards anyway. So try it out. Let me know if it works for you. Or stop by our website and tell us about your method for learning a new game, if it's different than mine. Okay. Time to talk about games. This month, we're taking a look at two games on the Battle of Gazala. Gazala the Cauldron by Roger Miller and Revolution Games, and Operation Theseus, Gazala 1942 by Dirk Blennerman and VUCA Simulations. The thrilling thing for me about the North African campaigns of World War II are the wild swings back and forth. The Italians initially push east, then the Allies push them back west, all the way to Algeria, and they capture Tobruk along the way. Rommel shows up and starts to push back east, but is somewhat hampered by a lack of supplies. So he bypasses Tobruk, pushes halfway to Egypt. Britain adds another corps to the theater, forming the famed Eighth Army, and then pushes the Axis all the way back to El Agilia again, relieving the defenders of Tobruk along the way. And then after receiving fresh supplies and reinforcements, the Axis drive back east again, pushing the Allies back to just outside Tobruk near the village of Gazala. And that's where a battle takes place. Spoiler alert, Rommel wins, takes Tobruk, which could now be used as part of the Axis supply line, And then Rommel and the Desert Rats push all the way to, Rommel and the Africa Corps push all the way east to Egypt. But then he gets defeated at Al Alamein twice and eventually driven all the way back past Tripoli. And that was kind of the end of the high point for the Africa Corps. Now they'd be driven westward by the 8th Army and then pinched from the west by the American British landings in Tunisia. And this is off the top of my head, but if I recall correctly, before that sort of pinching happened, Rommel left the theater. So apparently he's not the sort of leader to stick it out with his faithful troops. The games we're looking at today don't have any of that wild swing. They mark one of the many battles along the way. It was a critical prelude to taking Tobruk, which the Axis needed if they were to have any hopes of pushing into Egypt and staying there. It's an interesting battle in many ways. The Allies have a long line of minefields that the Axis must punch a route through to maintain their supply lines. The Allies also have several heavily fortified boxes or defensive positions along those minefields. The Axis have the advantage in armor and overall strength, as makes sense, as the attacking side. The units are also interesting. This is truly a World War battle. There's Italians and Germans on the Axis side, with British, Indian, French, and Australian units on the Allied side. As a side note, in the actual battle, rather than smashing through the minefield line, Rommel sent several panzer units to sweep around the southernmost tip of it and then head north once they got past it. But those units soon found themselves out of supply and had helped breach the Gazala minefield from the east. So they came along the bottom and then had to kind of attack back westward in the direction that it came from. The lack of supplies without a breach in the minefields, it's an important consideration that both games must take into account. Operation Theseus is the more detailed of the two games. It plays longer at about 10 hours compared to the Cauldron 6 or 7. The maps for the two games cover roughly the same area, east to west, and at the southern end, but while the Cauldron's northern edge is just north of the Knightsbridge box feature, Operation Theseus goes all the way to the coast and has Tobruk in the top right corner. It also goes just a little further east, but not much. The Cauldron has hexes that are a mile across. Theseus, their hexes are a little over 2 miles across. There's obviously differing opinions on some of the features, as it's 12 hexes from Bir Hakam to Rotunda Ualab on the Cauldron map, and it's 10 on the Theseus map, where you'd think it would be 5. So I don't know, somebody's got the distance wrong, but who knows? It's not going to make a big difference to us. The main thing is the strip of minefields and defenses of boxes along the western side is roughly the same shape on both maps and really dominates that half of the map. The Cauldron is 12 turns long, with each turn representing 1 to 2 days between May 27th and June 14th, whereas Theseus is only 8 turns, with each turn representing anywhere from 1 to 6 days. But in Theseus, units can be activated more than once, so each turn is really quite long. And both games represent, of course, the same 3 weeks of time. In the Cauldron, the units are brigades with the addition of a few Italian regiments. It's not precisely stated in Theseus, but as the HQs are divisions, it seems possible that the subunits are probably brigades with perhaps a few smaller anti-tank units added in. The units don't precisely match up from game to game. Some do, some don't. The divisions in the Cauldron have a few more units than in Theseus, but Theseus has more independent units, so perhaps it all evens out a bit. The Theseus counters are very colorful and appealing, but man, there's a ton of info on each one. Theseus uses drawings for the army units and symbols for the infantry and recon units, though they're not exactly NATO symbols, so they're not always the clearest to me. I got the hang of them after a bit. The Cauldron uses less colorful counters, still colorful, but not they're only two or three color, not the multicolor that Theseus has. But the Cauldron uses all NATO symbols, and both games use a system of color coding to make it clear which brigade or which division each brigade or which unit belongs to. All the divisions have their own colors. Both games use an activation system that sees one division at a time activated and used. The cauldron uses a traditional chip pull mechanic with a few twists. There's a turn track that lists which divisions chits go in the cup on any given turn. All the axis chits are double-sided, meaning you have to decide which division to activate when one of those chit is pulled. Interestingly, though, on some turns, there may be multiple copies of a single chit in the cup, meaning that you can activate a division more than once. And finally, also on the turn track, is a number of activations, the number of activations both sides get each turn. So even though you may have seven chits in the cup, you may only get five activations that turn. As well, each side has a handful of special events or capability chits in the cup. These might give you a little extra movement or a die roll modifier or something like that. They don't count against your activation total. Once each side has completed all their activations, the turn is over regardless of whether there are more events or unit chits left in the draw cup. So in a 12-turn game, each division might get activated once or twice per turn. There's obviously a bit of randomness and a bit of player choice as to which units see more action. Theseus has a much more involved activation system. There's no chit draw. Rather, when you have initiative, you get to choose which formation to activate. Each activation starts with an initiative roll to see who gets to go. If I get the initiative this time, next initiative roll, you'll get a +2 DRM to your die roll for the next initiative try. If I should happen to get the initiative again, then you'll get another +2 DRM, making it 4 DRM. So it's easy to get back-to-back activations, but it's less likely that you're going to get three or more in a row. When it's your turn to activate a division, there's a fair bit to look at. You get to choose which one, but each division has its own track that lists how many activations it gets each turn. The top limit is 5 or 6 for the allied units, and 5 or 7 for the axis units, with a few exceptions for the smaller units. Each time you activate a division, you move its marker down one. In between turns, the markers all move back up, and you get to the full use again, but not all the way. Each division is also rated for how many activations it recovers each turn, so some units recover much less than others, and they're therefore much less active than others, and you have to be careful how you spend their less frequent activations. Anyway, back to activating a unit. I did say it was a more involved process. You have to look at what the activation number was when you chose this unit, and you roll a die, you check a chart, and that will tell you how many activation points or action points that the unit will get this turn. Interestingly, when a unit is fresh and has many activations left, it's easy to roll and get 7 action points, but the lower your unit is on its own activation track, the more likely you're going to roll for much fewer activations, you know, maybe just 3 or 4. It sounds confusing, but it's really straightforward once you do it. These activation points can then be spent on moving, combat, refit, and a couple other things. More on those later after finishing how the activation works. One really special feature of Theseus is there's a degree of interactivity. If you've got an active division and you move a unit or a stack of units adjacent to one of my units or attempt to move a unit or stack of units away from being adjacent to one of my units, I can get a reaction activation opportunity. I have to roll versus a rating on my unit's HQ, but if successful, I roll in a special column on that activation chart and I'll get between 1 to 4 activation points to counterattack or move away or whatever with. I get sort of like a little mini activation. Of course, this will count as an activation for my unit, and its marker will go to one down on its track, leaving me with one less full activation possible for that unit. So, it's a trade-off. The Allies have 7 divisions. The Axis have 8 plus some smaller units. Each of these divisions will have multiple activations per turn. You can see, then, that each turn is a very long affair, with the early part of the turn featuring units with a ton of activation points, and slowly moving to the end of the turn where each unit has fewer APs to use. Even though it's only 8 turn long compared to Cauldron's 12, Theseus is rated to take 12 hours, whereas a Cauldron can be done in 6 or 7. So now we get to the meat of the action. What happens when a division is activated? Both games combine combat as a part of movement in a similar way that it costs either movement points or activation points to initiate combat, and the more movement points or action points you spend, the stronger your attack. In the Cauldron, the movement point allowances for each unit are larger. The time scale is a little bit different. I guess it makes sense because they're going to be activated far fewer times than in Theseus. Both games have a typical terrain effects chart with costs and modifiers for movement and combat. Pretty standard stuff. In the Cauldron, the pieces have a fresh side and a spent side with reduced ratings on the spent side. When a division is activated, all its pieces are flipped to the fresh side and you get to use each one. You move up to the limit of its movement allowance, but you can also stop at any time and also pay movement points to attack. The movement point costs depend on the unit, but it's roughly a third of its movement allowance for a light attack, two-thirds for a medium attack, and almost all for a heavy attack, which sort of simulates a set-piece battle, I guess. You'll then get a minus 2 DRM for your combat roll if you do a light attack, and a plus 2 DRM for your combat roll if you do a heavy attack. So after the unit attacks, as long as it wasn't forced to retreat or anything, and if it still has movement points left over, it can continue moving and maybe even attack again, depending on how many movement points it has left. When a unit attacks in a cauldron, interestingly, it's a little different. It's more the way you've seen this in kind of some old school games. A unit's got to attack all the enemy units that it's adjacent to. Any friendly units adjacent to any of those attacked units, though, can also be attacked. And crucially, there are no mandatory attacks. So you can move a few units into attacking position adjacent, where they'll be flipped to their spent sides, and then you move in your final attacking unit, which will attack from its fresh side. That way you get to add up all the attacking factors versus all the defending factors, and you get a good old-fashioned odds ratio for a roll on the CRT. There's also DRMs for the severity of the attack, as mentioned earlier, the hasty attack, the medium attack, or the prepared attack, as well as DRMs for terrain, supply, and disruption. You'll roll and generate effects on either the attacker or defender, or sometimes both. The results are step losses, retreats, or disruptions. In the Cauldron, about half the units are single step, but the maximum loss on any attack on the CRT is two steps, so it's not as bloody as you might expect. You can only lose those a maximum of two steps if things go really badly. And then if you have more units still waiting to be used, you can now move on and set up another battle, or you can move a new unit into an open space that allows it to attack the same units that were just attacked, and if they're adjacent to those same friendly units that attacked before, they can throw their factors in as support as well. So you can see in the Cauldron how sequencing your attacks is part of the fun of the game and really part of the strategy as well. In Theseus, attacks are more straightforward in the old, this is one hex for another versus another hex at heart. You remember how we generated the action points when we activated formation? Those action points can now be spent to use the formation's units. And the key rule here is that action points or activation points are spent on a hex, not per unit. So it costs the same amount of APs to activate a stack of three units to move as it costs to activate a single unit in a hex to move. This generates a fair bit of decision-making on whether to stack or spread out. The defending allies would like to spread out a bit to cover more ground, but they generally have fewer action points, so the stacking makes sense to get everybody in the action. The Axis needs to stack while on the move, or every unit won't get moved. There's a similar set of three attack strengths in Theseus as well. It costs a stack one action point to make a hasty or light attack, two APs to make a regular attack, and three APs to make a prepared attack. Rather than generating DRMs, though, these determine which column we'll use later as part of the attack process. Movement allowances are shorter in Theseus, but the units will get more of them, so it evens out. Attacks are a complicated process, and I'm not sure I'm going to do it justice by explaining it, but here goes. Say I have one unit or stack adjacent to you, and I declare an attack. It starts out as a hasty attack. You have the option as defender to attempt to retreat before combat by making a die roll. But if you're unsuccessful, I'll get a good dice roll modifier later in the process. If you don't retreat or can't retreat, at this point I can then spend more action points to turn my hasty attack into a regular or prepared attack. And then Now we really get into the weeds. In addition to a combat results table and DRMs, Theseus also has a cup of combat chits with a little grid on both sides. The rows equate to each unit's effectiveness rating. Each counter has this on its front, along with the many other ratings on these counters. Each unit's rated 1 to 6 for effectiveness. Then the rows depend on whether you are the attacker or defender. For the attacker, the rows represent hasty, regular, and prepared attacks, whereas for the defender, they represent whether the unit is disrupted, just in its regular state, or in a friendly minefield or improved defensive box. For each attacking unit, you cross-index the unit's effectiveness rating with the kind of attack it is, and you'll get a number between 1 and 3. And this number is the multiplier of that unit's attack value. So you have to do that for each attacking unit. So you're going to multiply each unit's... each unit might have a different multiplier depending if they have different effectiveness ratings. They'll all be making the same type of attack, but they might have different effectiveness ratings. Anyway, you get these multipliers, you multiply it out, you add all your units totals together, and that's going to give you a giant number for your attack value. And then for each defending unit, a similar thing happens. You cross-index each defending unit's effectiveness rating with its state, whether it's disrupted, regular, or improved defense, and you'll again get a multiplier for its defense strength. Then you add up all the multiplied attack strengths for a total attack, do the same for all the multiplied defense strengths to get a total defense, and we finally have our initial combat odds ratio. The combat results table here is interesting, as the column you end up on depends upon the defending terrain. I guess it's pretty much like having a column shift for terrain types, but it's just handled differently. There's a shifting set of numbers for each terrain type. And then there's a bunch of other little DRMs. You get DRMs for each side that has its headquarters unit in range. The Axis will get a DRM if they've got air power activated and available. Each side could get a DRM for combined arms, if applicable. And importantly, while this is just one hex against another hex, any friendly rating, friendly units that are adjacent to the combat hex for both sides, you'll get a DRM. Each side will get a DRM for that. Oh, and then there's also a shift for who has the most armor or anti-tank points in the combat, which is just more ratings on the counters. Anyway, you figure out which column you're on, you've got your final DRM, you roll, and you get a result that says how many hits the attacker takes and how many hits the defender takes. And this is where the dreaded hit point chits come in. I'm no fan of these hit point chits. In this game, the unit strengths can go anywhere from like 4 to 16, sort of. So there's these strength chits that are they're just chits that they'll have like 1, 2, 3, 4 around the four sides on the one side, and then 5, 6, 7, 8 on the other side. Then there'll be other chits that have 7, 8, 9, 10 on one side and 9, 10, 11, 12, you see what I mean. Anyway, if I have a unit, say that it started with a strength of 12 and it takes 2 hits, then I need to put a strength chit underneath it that with a 10 facing up. So to indicate how many hits it actually has now. It doesn't have its stated 12. In this game, Theseus, it's not long before most of the units have a strength chip beneath them, which makes for, higher stacks and more fiddliness. There is an alternative way you can play where you record strengths on a side record, but either way, it's fairly fiddly. Okay, I know that sounded like a lot, and it is, but I have to say, it's not so bad once you've been through it a few times. The hardest part for me was keeping track of the products of the multiplication in my head. All those as I had to add them up and then remember all the ones for the attacker as I worked through what the defender's was. I should have just written them down, but anyway. Oh, I should say, as well as hits, units may also have to take an effectiveness check as a result of that, whatever's rolled on the CRT. And any units that fail, they're flipped to their disrupted side. And disruption in this game means that a unit can no longer move or attack. Disruption ends automatically at the end of the turn, but in this game, there's a lot of activations per turn, so that can put a unit out of commission for a long time. So there's another way you can remove the disruption marker. You can spend disrupted unit's division is activated. You can spend an activation point on it to do a refit action, which involves rolling against one of its ratings, maybe its effectiveness rating, and recovering it that way. It's not a sure thing, but if you've got a key unit that's disrupted, it's a way to get it back in action and not have to wait for the end of the turn. Okay, that was a long and painful explanation. But I think you can see the big differences in combat in particular between these two games. In the Cauldron, losses are not quite as common, but when you do lose, you lose either a whole unit or a half unit, if the unit had two steps. Whereas in Theseus, there's losses in every combat, but they degrade units much more slowly. Another key feature in games about Gazala are the minefields and defensive boxes and how they interact with supply and victory conditions. In both games, there's a long string of mines and improved positions running from the top near the west edge almost all the way down to the bottom of the map, ending at Bir Hakeim. There's just one or two hexes below this on both maps. In the actual battle, it was critical for the Axis to find a way through the minefields and open a route east along one of the roads through those minefields to keep the supply line open. In fact, several German units swept down around the bottom of Bir Hakeim, but then had to back westerly to help open the breach as they had put themselves kind of far out of supply. Both games make you open a breach through the minefields in their own way. In Theseus, the supply rules are a fair bit more detailed, as you might imagined, and you simply can't trace supply around the bottom of Bir Hakeim and keep it open. Armored units might stay in supply for a bit, but leg units just won't even get around there. So it's built right into the supply rules in Theseus that you have to get through there. In the Cauldron, on the other hand, there's just a rule that says the Axis has to have a breach route through the minefields and be able to trace a simple line of communications from the west edge board through the breach into that center area to at least eight Axis units on the far side of the line, or they're going to lose automatically. And that's by they have to have it done by May 29th, which in that game is turn three. In both games, there's a variety of victory point hexes to be fought over on the east side of the line. So given that both the Axis does get through, then it's a battle for all those victory spots. There's a few other differences, of course, but that's the basic difference in broad strokes. Generally, it's a case of Theseus being a little more detailed and fiddly. They both have special rules for how you breach those minefields, and they both handle supply in their own way. But I think you can sort of see where this is all going. So I imagine you're expecting me to pick one or the other by now, but I have to say it's not an easy choice. Theseus is certainly more fiddly. It's got a super involved combat system that has a ton of detail in it. I'm not totally sold that all that fiddliness and detail is worth it. And I do really hate having strength markers under every unit. But that said, I've got to admit, it allows for a much finer degree of planning and management than the Cauldron. The Cauldron, it's a little more chaotic due to its random chip draws for activations, and much less fine-grained in how it handles losses. But I like that chaos, and if you played Cells, which is the previous game in this little series that Roger Miller's done for Revolution Games, I like the Cauldron even more than I like Cells, so that tells you how much I like the Cauldron. Anyway, I suppose if pressed, I'd just narrowly pick the Cauldron to play. Theseus is much more attractive in terms of its components, but the fiddliness factor is large. But, That said, it really is a toss-up. I'm definitely going to be playing both of them again, as they're both perfect for a long day or over a weekend. Okay, time to hear from Sam London. Sam is new to tabletop wargame design, but not new to gaming, as he worked in the video game industry for years. So how great is it to find someone who specifically prefers to design board wargames rather than video games? Here's our conversation.
There we go. All right, I'm here at SD HisCon with Sam London, designer with a game coming up on through GMT. Is it on the hello, Sam. How are you?
Hello. Fine. How are you?
I'm good. Is it on the P500 already? Or
it is. We just hit 400 today.
Oh, so it's going to make it no problem.
Thank you. I'm pretty happy with the momentum we've had. It's only been up on P500 for about 6 weeks.
And Firefight Tactical, is that the name of it? Yeah. Cool. Is this your first design? I've just played the demo with you, so I'm feeling pretty jazzed about the game, but we'll get to that.
Good time to record it then.
Yeah.
So I've been designing games for 20 years, but I've been very down on myself about who would actually want to play this stuff? And it was actually Firefight Tactical was the first thing I pitched to anybody, and I pitched it to Gene, GMT, and he pretty much took it on the spot.
Right, yeah.
And so
he spoke really highly of it in his newsletter.
Yeah, which was, I was kind of in shock. I've been doing this for so long and wasn't thinking anybody would ever like any of the stupid things I write down. But then all of a sudden I had this, maybe some people would like this stuff. And so I started to try to sell around some of my other designs, and people have been picking those up too. So
right. So I notice you have more than one design here on that you're demoing. You've got three games that you're demoing.
I actually have five.
Oh, is that right?
But only two of them, I have no. I'm not in an effort to sell right now.
Right.
There is, but one of them I'm selling to another company, which I haven't contacted yet, and then the other one I'm kind of tooling with. But I'm at any given time I'm working on quite a number of games.
So you've been designing for 20 years, and it's taking you that long to feel like, okay, I'm gonna pitch this thing. Well, obviously you got 20 years of experience, so it makes your first pitch go pretty well with GMT.
It also helps that I mean, it was the video games industry, but I've been on the creative and the business side of the video games industry. And so there's a lot of analogs there with, analog gaming. So,
right.
Nothing shocks me.
Is that still your day job?
No. I left that several years ago for something with a little bit more reliability. The development cycle in the video game industry can be pretty punishing.
Yeah.
So I went into general tech so I could stop getting laid off every 2 years and, let my wife sleep a little bit better at night.
Have a life, yeah. I hear you. That's good. But you've taken a lot, you said, that you learned from that development, being on the development side of software, that's applicable to what they might be looking for when you're trying to pitch a game?
First off, just the general flow of development, the development process, I'm familiar with it. It's more similar than it's different between the two. And then on the other side, just having to communicate creative ideas with a mind towards the market and how you're going to appeal to people, it's all the same.
And was that the side of the video game industry you were working on, the creative side or the...
So I was a producer for some time, but my primary career, and still is now, is essentially consulting around big data. And so it was just looking at, financial metrics and product metrics and saying, hey, this is where we should reinvest and this isn't working out and how are we going to actually measure all that? And
right.
So,
and if we don't fix this, you're going to lay me off.
Yeah, exactly. So, it translated quite well to getting into this. And it was actually, I told them after the fact, it worked out with, and specifically with Firefight Tactical, I designed it for GMT. I didn't design it thinking, oh, we'll see if somebody buys
right,
it.
Right, right.
I specifically designed it for GMT thinking, I hope it would do really cool things for expanding their market. And I was like, I want this to be something that's a little bit of an olive branch between the tactile gamers and the general war gamers, but even the Euro crowd a little bit.
Right, because this game, for people who haven't seen it, there's no board. Mm-hmm. It's similar to an older game like Upfront or something in that the you make the map as you go with the terrain cards or what have you. So it's got some, when you look at it on the table, it in no way looks like a traditional Hex and Counter game or anything like that. It's going to have some, and also there's a ton of dice. It's not a dice chucker. It's a dice drafter. So it's going to have some visual appeal to the Euro gamers who are going to be familiar with dice drafting, and they're not going to be scared away by a big map board of Sicily or whatever.
Right. I mean, I've been a big war game fan for years, but like I said, with designing games all this time, I always want to design a war game, but I never had any inspiration to design a war game. And then it just suddenly hit me, and I was like, I think this would be great for GMT, where they are as a business. I think it would be really cool. And so, as I alluded to earlier, I told them after the fact, I was like, yeah, if you didn't buy it, I was going to throw it in the bin. And it was, they just ended up, getting really excited about it. And now all of a sudden, I'm having war game design ideas as much as I'm having non-war game design ideas.
So, given the fact that they published Combat Commander, which was like there's a million World War II tactical games out there, and
I own them.
Yeah, me too. But there's always this feeling like, oh, everything's been done in that space. Yeah. And then Chad Jensen does Combat Commander, and then Last 100 Yards is kind of different. It's like, and those are both GMT. So in some ways, GMT was like, they're the people who go like, oh, this is new. And yeah. Like they were the right people to approach and the right people to design for.
Which is why, I mean, to be perfectly honest, this is going to sound like I'm sucking up, but I do intend to also work with other companies. But they're just such a pleasure to work with. And they see the hobby very similarly to how I see the hobby, speaking generally. And so it's just a pleasure to work with them because, when I'm like, hey, this is really strange, but I think people will dig it. And they're like, yeah, I think it, as opposed to, this is unfamiliar, this isn't really what we do, and pumping the brakes. They don't do that, and I love that.
I think, given the fact that they're sort of like the big player in the industry, they're surprisingly open. They're not stodgy in any way. No. They've got lots of young people working for them, and they're totally open to new ideas, and I think you'd have a harder time selling an old-fashioned game to them that's been done a ton.
Which, I mean, again, kind of going back to my background, it's really refreshing because I worked for big-name companies like Electronic Arts in the video games industry, and if it's not something that's tried and true, they won't make it
right.
Because it's too much of a risk. It's just really wonderful that that's not a thing, at least not with GMT.
Yeah, absolutely. So you say you played like a million tactical games before, designing your own. What were your favorite tactical games? What were the things that you went, I got to steal a bit from this, or not even that. Just like, what were your favorites to play?
So I always will have a safe spot in my heart for ASL. I own way too much ASL.
I'm with you.
I actually have had two very large collections of ASL. I sold the first one and then I rebought all.
I'm on my second. Yeah. I'm with you.
I love ASL. I always considered ASL like tactical World War II chess. And it was, yeah, there's luck in it, but you have so much understanding of what's going on. It's not a simulation. I'm not one of those guys.
Yeah,
but I have so much fun with it. And so you probably noticed a fair amount of the guts of Firefight Tactical is back to old squad leader stuff.
Not in a slavish recreation way, but just sort of like
the core engine.
We're gonna have these squads. We're gonna have these leaders. Yeah. We're gonna have these support weapons.
If it's not broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, stone buildings are a +3 TEM.
Yeah, right.
It's like
exactly.
All this stuff is totally familiar.
So ASL is a big one for me. Combat Commander, huge. Combat Commander is tremendous. I mean, I will explain this to you now. I didn't explain it to you in at the table, but. I absolutely adore Combat Commander for the exact opposite of the reason I just said I love ASL, because they do different things for me. I love that I don't have complete control over the situation in Combat Commander.
Same here.
I love that I'm being faced with an actually difficult decision. What's the best I can make of the situation I'm in? And obviously that is the chief thing that inspires the core engine of Firefight Tactical. I love Band of Brothers because Band of Brothers, when I'm playing it, I have to make realistic choices because the system is set up to punish you mercilessly if you are not using some semblance of real tactics while you're trying to address the situation. And I love, and I'm going to throw it out here just to throw a redheaded stepchild into the mix, I love Heroes of Normandy. I was really disappointed to hear that Flying Pig just went under.
There's a big mess right there,
Or yeah. Devil Pig, sorry. But I love Heroes of Normandy because it's so bombastic and it just tells awesome stories on the table.
Yeah, it's like, I think of ASL as a great storyteller, and it feels like Heroes of Normandy went, oh, I like that.
Yeah.
That's the part of ASL I like. Let's make every scenario like a movie. And
its table presence is incredible. And so those are probably the big four for me.
Yeah.
I also like Conflict to Heroes would be another one I enjoy. Those are probably the...
Those are good choices. I like all of those. So let's spin over to what else you're demoing at the... I've only seen your one game.
I'm only at liberty to speak about one of them.
Okay.
The next game, I'm working on all of these at the same time.
Yeah.
End game, I'm pitching to GMT in the spring, which I'm really excited about. That my only tease I'll say for that is it has an unlimited player count. But I'm really excited for everything I'm working on. The next thing I actually can talk about is called Absolfmal Allegiance. It's a World War II. That's World War II. I'm saying World War II all day. It's an American Revolution strategic level war game. Assuming it goes over well. It's going over well here.
Yeah.
The first in a series I'm calling the Will to Fight system. And so the Will to Fight system is a trick-taking game. So you have these unique decks to the different sides, and each card in the deck is unique, and they're playing a trick-taking game that decides the actions they're able to carry out, and the initiative of the war is being handled by who's winning the tricks.
And so we're doing the it's strategic level, so we're doing the complete American Revolution.
Yeah. And you also have economic factors, some you have to worry about.
Right, which is like, you know, there's been a lot of discussion online and elsewhere these days about when we get to strategic level, let's have some economic factors, let's have political factors, let's have social factors, like let's get it all in there, right?
And so the game is quite asymmetrical. And so it's really an interesting, fast-playing AMREV game. And the core notion, besides the trick-taking, is revolves around this track called the Will to Fight track. That's the name of the system. And there are things that are constantly diminishing their respective sides' willingness to continue the war. And it's very different for the two of them. So for the colonials, they're actually the people's willingness to continue to fight for independence. In the case of Britain, they never had support of the people. So it's not so much that. It's Parliament's willingness to continue to fund the conflict. And so the things that trigger them to tick down is totally different. And eventually, because they're on the same track, they'll converge. And once their willingness to fight converges, that's how you end up with the side suing for peace. And then you do final scoring.
Right.
And
right.
So it's a very...
So with two tracks converging, you're obviously... Each side is wanting to push farther into the other side's half or whatever.
Well, actually, they're trying to pull. It's the opposite. They're trying to pull the other side closer into their neighborhood.
They're trying to not go up the track as fast as the other person.
And so it's a cool thing. I'm really liking it, and I've without going into it, it's going over well enough that I already have some other designers that are saying, like, we want to do the next game in this system. Are you open to it? And I would love to... endeavor to take a pulse out of Volker Runka's book and do Discord and just say
just do
everybody
it. Yeah, let's what are you at? Yeah. that whole design studio or design atelier via Discord, I think that's the way of the future for
it's like, really inspiring.
It's just great, you know, like the openness and there's no fear of somebody's going to steal my idea.
Yeah.
It's just like let's put all the good ideas on the table and make something out of it.
Yeah, so. I do. There are two conflicts I won't name now. One in particular that I want to do later in the system. This is kind of proving out that the system works the way I want to and that there's interest for it.
Yeah.
But there is one in particular conflict I won't let anybody else speak right, to, but the rest, everybody go nuts.
Right, you know, but you can stake that ground out from the from the get go. Yeah. And you have a publisher for that one already?
GMT is GMT also going to do that one.
So that's why you can talk about that.
Yeah, that's why I can talk about that one.
Yeah, yeah.
The other ones I can't talk about, they are also picked up, but I can't go into detail.
Yeah, totally, totally fine. Well, okay, so that's all we can talk about your new games. Let's talk about your what else you're doing while you're at the convention. Like, are you spending your whole time?
I'm pretty much demoing.
You're demoing. You're not getting a chance to play anybody else's stuff, or?
Well, I'm really lucky. So I actually host a board game convention at my house twice a year, and 3 days of gaming, pretty, you know, maybe 5 hours to sleep, and that convention wrapped a week ago. So I'm not hurting for playtime right now.
Right. And you're still a pretty active gamer then.
I try. Right. It's hard. I got a 4-month-old right now and a 6-year-old. The form, you know, it's harder than it used to be. But
yeah, totally. It's like I've always said, well, like, you get the second child isn't like just adding a plus one. It's like somehow it's like 2 times 2, and
it's a thing. But at the same time, it's obviously that's great. But I'm starting to hit that point where my 6-year-old is like really excited that daddy designs board games. And that gives me, like, so much more oomph to, because now I can get him to, he can't play any of this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's, like, kind of getting to that point where he's, like, aspiring to play these kind of games with me is so much gas to
Do you go think with. That's going to inspire you to make some, like, entry-level games that you, just because you go, if I make this game, I can play it with my son? And
I'm one of these, I have no idea how other designers do what they do. The way I do things is I'm driving, and then all of a sudden my muse speaks to me, and I'm just like, oh, let me think about that for 6 months. Maybe there's a game there.
Right.
You know, I have no control, honestly, about what I end up designing. It's just I either have the thought or I don't. And so I haven't had the inspiration to do any entry-level games, but if they're there, I'll do it.
Right. Well, the thing about entry-level games, too, is, or not so much about the games, but trying to do that for your kids is, your kids quite quickly, I guess I have to say this, is I got a 21-year-old son. They go through that entry-level phase really fast.
Yeah.
And they spend the whole rest of their life appreciating your more sophisticated designs.
Have you ever heard of Quora Quest? It was a recent game. It was on Kickstarter. I forget the guy's name, but it was a very independent game that came out of the UK. And the guy designed it in concert with his daughter. And so it was very geared towards young dungeon crawl,
right?
You know, players. Yeah. And I bought it to play with my son, and it's been like 8 months, and I'm afraid he's already aged out of it before I got to the table. I totally hear you.
They age out of games the same way they age out of shoes, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you've got these two games with GMT that are on the track. You got three others that are.
Can't comment.
Can't comment, but they're out there. Uh-huh. You're obviously really busy with the designs you already are working on. Do you, like, what's the future going to look like for you?
This isn't going to show up on the recording, but I can show you later. I am ruled by this Gantt chart I have of all my designs, and there's too many. And so I got to be careful with what I say, because some of the ones I would talk about I probably am going to try to sell to this crowd, but... I hit a point, and there's a problem. And I say, how am I going to solve this? And then I don't think about it for 8 months, 9 months. And then all of a sudden, it just hits me. I'm like, that's how I fix it. And then I'm back on it.
Right,
and
right. So it's like you got a bunch of balls in the air, and some of them are really high, and then they come back down later, and you go, ah.
Yeah. And so I have a lot of things that I can return to at various times. Right now, I have people I am working with for enough games that should alone keep me busy.
Right.
But this one I teased that I'm going to pitch to GMT in the spring, I'll make time for that.
right.
But the other ones, you know, when it hits me, that's time to go back. I'll go back to it.
Well, and you said, you know, when the muse hits you, it hits you. So you're... if you get yet another idea that you got to get started, it's
I hope
just,
not.
It's just going to happen.
I need time to work on the ones I got. I also have a day job. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say, I've talked to quite a few designers, and there's quite a few that work like you work, where it's like an explosion of activity on a certain design until they hit a roadblock, and then it just gets...
Well, there's nothing for it. I mean, you have so many times where...
But then when the solution hits out of the blue, that's the fun part.
Yeah, I spoke to a friend of mine who's a painter, and we were talking about the times in his career where he's worked on commission, and he said it's horrible because you have moments where you're just not feeling it, but you got to do it anyway.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad I don't have to do that. If I force the design because I had to get it to a certain place in a certain period of time, it's probably not going to be the best version of that game it can be.
Right.
You know, it's better to wait for when it's like, that's it. That's the way it's supposed to be. And then
I can't remember who I was talking to, and they said that was the reason they'd been approached to design some for magazine games. Mm-hmm. And they went... I can't do it because like the magazine timeline is unforgiving. Mm-hmm. You know, if I had a game that was perfect for a magazine, I would give it to them, and then I could figure out where to put it in the timeline. But if they said, "We want you to do a game for our November issue," it was like, "No,
I can't even imagine." I mean, Firefight Tactical. I was at the point where I was ready to pitch it. After about 5 months of development, and they took it, but then it was after that they're okay, great, that's exciting. Let's talk about all this other stuff. Systems wise, I was good to go. I hit writer's block. They don't know this, but I hit writer's block on the scenarios for like 5 months. I could not come up with a thought, and it was horrific. I was starting to actually get worried. Like, when are they going to ask for more scenarios? I'm not ready to show them anything. And then one day, four scenarios like that,
right?
And it was. Just there.
And then how many scenarios are going to come with it?
12.
12. Yeah. Well, here's the other question that always goes with tactical games is like, if this takes off and hits as we hope it will, then do we get to see a Soviet box? Do we get to see a box of Commonwealth?
So they haven't told me I can't say any of this, and I think I'm fine because it all depends on how well the game sells anyway.
Right, yeah.
But, so the core box, it was originally my plan. I want to have a random scenario generator in it, and it's extremely robust, and I am over the moon happy with it. But the problem was it was going to double the number of components because I want to be able to create mega scenarios.
Right.
And so they pumped the brakes on me, rightfully so. And so getting into, okay, what's going to fit into the box? It's like, we got the core experience, and we got the bot, right? So we can do the solo, and we're good.
Yeah.
And then I said, okay, well, if we're, depending on how well it sells, that next thing that's going to come in, it's going to be the random scenario generator, an expansion for the bot, and multiplayer rules, and we're good. And then I can fire that off tomorrow.
Right,
if I had to.
Yeah.
But then... beyond that, I already have the Soviets entirely designed. I'm pretty happy with them. And so, yeah, I was going to do an Eastern Front scenario, and the idea there was that was going to come with the Winter Terrain deck.
Right.
And then I wanted to do, like, a Ziploc expansion that would give you scenarios so you could take that Winter Terrain deck back to your core game and do your Winter War Battle of Bulge. And
do your Bulge and whatnot,
And then, but yeah, I mean, again, depending on how well it goes, I want to do North Africa, I want to do the Pacific, and I've had some... people coming up to me about it, they're really excited about taking it to some other places, maybe doing other conflicts.
Well, just think about doing like Italy or somewhere where you get the Brits and the Canadians in there, so that all us Commonwealth people get our guys.
All of this is written down places. You know, no one has to twist my arm to make games. You know, it's a question of whether the desire's there, and so. I'm waiting for that.
The random scenario generator, were you inspired to go along that direction from the one in Combat Commander? Was that...
I was inspired. They're nothing alike.
Right.
But I did... It was already a design goal of the game, which we discussed before the recording, that I wanted to have it where the game has a much higher replayability factor than tactical games usually do.
Right.
And so that's already there just from the random setup of the board. but I wanted to go turn it up to 11 and just have it like, okay, let's sit down. We've played these scenarios 100 times. Let's just have an entirely random scenario with a random order of battle and just see what happens.
Right.
And so...
And just have a filter to make it approximately balanced as much as you can in a random scenario.
And it came out really great. And so what I decided I'm going to do, despite the fact that I can't fit the components for it in the core box, is I'm going to put the logic for it in the core box so that people can make their own scenarios with the components that are there
right.
and have them be balanced. And it's so easy to put together a random scenario right. for the game. So they could just do that and then save it for the expansion to be able to do your giant maps that are like a river, you know, running through and, you know, going into the hills on the other side. All the, you know, these mega scenarios that I'm really excited about. We can wait till then.
Well, it also, you know, when you're talking about replayability, you know, I think about a game, another card game similar to, to yours, like Upfront. And that scenario A, the, you know, meeting of patrols,
sure.
has been played a million times and it's different every time.
Absolutely.
Because in the same as you, like, the terrain cards are random and where they come up is going to change the game immensely every time you play it.
Yeah.
And yours is the same way. We played a demo today where I think the grid was like maybe 5x5?
It was 5x4.
5x4, yeah.
It was the share board.
Are they all 5x4 or is the grids are different?
They're different. That was a bit smaller than the Carentan scenario. The Carentan one is really odd because what I did with the Carentan one is it's actually, there's two different terrain decks. And so you have a rural terrain deck for the approach. And then you have the urban terrain deck for the city.
For the city, right.
And so it's a much longer, it's a wider scenario. The quicker ones, and this will go in also for the scenario design notes for when you want to make your own custom scenarios, 4x4 is like the smaller ones. The 4x4 scenarios, you usually, apparently I was really happy to hear this, but Jason Carr and his wife have been playing the first scenario, Firefight Tactical, a few times, and they're getting through their games in a half hour.
Right.
And so I was really happy to hear that. But on the complete opposite side of it, yeah, there's the sky's the limit, but in my mind, it's probably somewhere in the order of about like 6x8 is probably your mega scenario.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the one we played today was a fairly meaty scenario, but we got through it in just an hour, hour and a quarter, something like that. And, you know, it was fully immersive. It was like it didn't feel like a training scenario in any way.
Well, it wasn't. That's scenario 7, so it should be.
Yeah, no, it was deep in there, but it didn't feel like, you know, in a game that lasted an hour to an hour and a half, it didn't feel like there was a lack of choices or a lack of depth there. It felt like, you know, you were deep in, like, in ASL or Upfront or Combat Commander, any of your favorites. Yeah,
I mean, that's great to hear. I mean, yeah, it's. I wanted it to be, and I'm hopefully you can appreciate this from the time you've had with it. I really wanted it to get to the point where that first game that you have of it, you're playing your tactical, right, and you're making your maneuvers and everything. But once you play it more, you start to see this die is extremely important to my opponent. I'm going to take it, even though I'm going to do nothing important with it, just to steal the momentum.
I kept feeling that in our game, because I kept feeling like you were taking the die that I wanted.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. And it was actually, I didn't call this out for you then. If you actually look, regardless of what nation you're actually talking about, the Axis forces and the Allied forces, their dice menus are inverted. Very intentionally, and so as you're taking aggressive actions with whoever you are, you're limiting the mobility of your opponent. So the more you're aggressing upon them, the harder of a time they have getting it together to move. And similarly, the more you're moving, the harder time they have consolidating fire to meaningfully lay it down. And so I put that in there intentionally. So even in the beginning, when people don't know how to hate draft and know what they got to pull, they're still limiting each other's options without even knowing it.
Right. Yeah. Just by doing the right thing, And that's going to be fairly easy to go forward with the other nationalities because you just keep them in a line. Yeah. You say you have the other Russians completely designed, how the little menu you have for each unit of what they can do based on which dice they get to choose. how different is like a Russian line infantry unit from an American line in terms of what they can do? Like, what's the kind of the nationality tweaks you get to do?
So I intentionally left the Germans and the Americans relatively similar. If you put the same, like a recon squad against a recon squad, you'll see kind of where I was going with it. It'll be, because ultimately the knobs, I call them knobs, and when I'm explaining right. how I design, the knobs are the stats themselves. So maybe one has slightly better morale, maybe one has slightly better firepower, or range or whatever. But the bigger knob is the dice.
Yeah.
Because then the dice is, the more restrictive the dice are, the harder they are to command. And so that's where a lot of the back and forth is between the Americans and the Germans. For the Soviets, the wheels come off the train, because I'm like, all right, we've done the core box. This is the engine without doing anything crazy. Let's get nuts. And so for the Soviets, this is going to be early war Soviets. So they're poor quality. There's a lot of them.
Yep.
Their morale is trash, but there are way more leaders. They're lower quality leaders, but they're everywhere. And so them holding the line and keeping the fight going is going to be, it's definitely going to feel very different as the Germans going against the Soviets than against the Americans.
And do you envision it as a full box that comes with Russians and Germans? Or it's just the Russians and then you use the Germans from the original core box?
So that's something I'm not clear on yet. I'm inclined to do as a pure expansion and get into a little bit more esoteric unit types with the Germans, and then use that to kind of backfeed, get excitement, say, all right, now we have excuse to do an expansion that let's get esoteric with the Americans.
You're talking my language. I was hoping you were going to say that. I like it when you have the core and then you just build in one nationality after another, and like you say, maybe add a few extra units for the nationalities that you already have. That's amazing.
I don't need redundant Germans. I want to get into, let's have some a little bit more obscure weaponry. Let's get in more types of vehicles, more armor.
And also, like, who needs to go, like, well, these were the 1941 Germans, but then these were the late summer 41 Germans. Yeah. It's like, no, let's just have the Germans and, you know.
And
like,
I want to, from a design perspective, so every infantry unit in the game, it can fire, it can move, and it can take cover. And then it has two other actions that are unique to it.
Right,
and so those two actions are where all their flavor comes in. And so I really want to have some more fun, and let's bring in some more unique actions, some more unique unit types, and just especially then you take that, because that's the other part, again, is I to me, I always wanted Firefight Tactical in the end to be like a tactical toolbox. And so you got all this cool stuff, great, and this isn't a spoiler, but this is part of the random scenario generator, is every single release is, here's the new tables for the random scenario generator. You got new toys, let's throw it into the box. and more to mix it up.
I totally agree with your philosophy there. One of the things that's always kept me attracted to ASL, because I'm like you, I'm a junkie for that, is that they went nationality by nationality by nationality, and they, like, I get, as much as I like other tactical systems, I play them and I like them, but it's like I don't appreciate them when they go, this tactical system is based on the 29th Infantry Division or whatever, or the Gross Deutschland Division. Sure. It's like, no, give me all the German. Let's keep it wide open. Give me all the U.S. Let's, don't limit me to the actions of one division when you're making your scenarios, and let's think way wider.
That's actually, I've only had this conversation once so far. I anticipate it's going to happen more. Is that I'm checking certain boxes with my scenarios so far, and so we have. Colville's probably the least of them, but you got your Carentan, you got your St. Mary Glees, you got your St. Lo, you got your Eindhoven, this is all going to be in there. And people are like, okay, yeah, well, you're hitting the cliche stuff. Where's the nitty gritty? So I'm like, if you want to do these smaller unit actions or all whatever you want to do, you have the system.
Yeah.
Make it, please, and then share it. Like, let's...
Totally. And if you have, and if you're going to start with U.S. Germany as the first two nations, And if the something you want from the Italian campaign isn't there, you can design your own
scenario.
Well,
that'll be step two. Assuming it sells well, people are eating up the Soviets. That's where we're going. Is we're gonna hit up North Africa and Italy. I figure I'll do it as one expansion, just a Mediterranean expansion.
Good, because then you can put the British in there. Yep. And the Canadians.
Could even maybe do it. Might do it as a that could be a second core box actually. Right. Then they'll be all new. But
I feel like I'm talking to somebody like a candy seller or something.
you're
speaking my language.
I get excited about all this stuff. I love talking about it.
Yeah, I'm all good. Well, is there anything else you want to tell us about what you're up to or these?
I really hope that Firefight Tactical doesn't scare people off because it looks so odd. But as I said this to you when we kicked off, it was like, and you were picking up on it from the get-go, but it was like everything you're used to is here. You know, it's you're gonna know what you're doing. If you're a tactical person, because this was, I will say this, I shared this with you earlier. I designed this specifically to try to get tactical people to have an easier time playing tactical games with non-tactical people. And still have every bit as much fun doing it. And when people do look at it, I'm concerned they look at it and they think, oh, that looks weird. You know, and I'm like, if you give it a shot, if you sit down and you look at this, it is going to be so familiar.
Yeah.
it's going to blow your socks off.
It is. Like all the concepts are familiar for sure.
Yeah.
Even if you haven't played up front, it's going to still feel totally familiar.
Yeah.
To, you know, you have line of sight, you have mm-hmm. firepower, you've got all the things you're used to.
So I hope people get excited about it. I'm. It seems they are. I hope they keep getting more excited about it because, I have somewhat famously said, I was designing games for this long. Firefight Tactical was not my guess of what was going to be the first one to get picked up.
Yeah.
It immediately is a very special place in my heart,
right?
People are excited. Awesome, and so yeah, if people are feeling it, I'll keep making it.
Well, the other thing I should note about, so, you know, you're talking about, I hope people look at it and don't get put off by how different it looks from other games. I know, you know, we were playing with your prototype today, so there's nothing to do with final art or anything like that. But I have to let you know that the brightness and the clarity of the art is appealing. Sometimes some of these tactical games, they feel like they need to make it dark and nitty gritty, and it's like, no, you don't. Mm-hmm. No, the green is a color, yellow is a color.
Yeah.
Everything doesn't have to be gray and black and brown.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. I talk about this quite a bit. This is my own failings as a person. So again, coming from the video games industry, I have video game and an analog game. I have played more prototypes from people than I can begin to count. And the thing is, I am apparently a very superficial person. And so when they're put it in front of me, and it could be a great game, but I have to work mentally to put myself there to say, okay, if this was fully arted, if this had good graphic design, not that my graphic design is good, but it's there.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and all these things, how would I feel about this as a completed product? And I am so bad at that, I have to assume everybody else is as bad as it as I am. So whenever I design a game, pretty much no one sees my paper prototypes. My wife does.
Right.
And then as soon as I'm ready to show it to people, I go nuts and do the kind of thing that you saw in there.
Yeah.
Because it's – and I get the feedback that people appreciate it, because then they're like, okay, yeah, now I can focus on is it fun? Because that's ultimately what matters.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
And I'd rather have that conversation than trying to imagine.
Yeah, right. I'm looking at a card that has all the stats put out nicely. There's a illustration of what the unit is and everything like that. It's so much easier to just be instantly absorbed rather than looking at a card that just has, like, in, you know, 8-point font, mm-hmm. the stats.
Yeah. Yeah. And now you can focus on, would you play this?
Yeah.
Now I can imagine it as
well. And you can imagine it, and also you can see the things about it that make it sort of compelling. Like the dice drafting that you were talking about, you're looking at the unit, the little unit cards for each unit, and they have the dice, a little drawing of the dice menu of what it costs to do which action. And as somebody who's coming from, you know, has never seen it before, it's like,
that's intriguing. It's like, how is that going to work? How, like, I got to roll that to do, you know, like.
Every time somebody walks by, they look at the terrain cards, they look at the dice, but they kind of look at them like, oh, what's that? That's weird. And then if they actually look at the counter, they do a double take. Because, like, why are there all these dice? Well, and I'm like, I got them.
Do you ever know a game, Steampunk Rally?
Yeah, I love Steampunk Rally.
Yeah, that I think that's probably the only dice drafter I've played. But, like, when I saw your, I was like, oh, I get how this is going to work. Mm-hmm. This is going to be great.
Yeah. No, it's, yeah, that's, I, when people see that, then they're going like, okay, what is this? And then I'm like, okay, let's, it's pitch time. And that's
right.
That's my
that's
big,
your hook.
Yeah.
Well, that all sounds great, Sam. I'm so glad I got a chance to talk to you. So glad I got a chance to play that. Cause, like a, you know, tactical World War II tactical, World War I in the air. Those are kind of like my two favorite genres. So, I can't wait to see how it looks when, you know, the final art gets done.
Yeah, me too.
All right.
But it was a great game, man. I really appreciate you, your interest and taking the time.
Oh, no problem. Mm-hmm. Have a good time for the rest of the convention.
Yep, you too.
Oh, thanks.
Okay. I really have to encourage you to check out Sam's game on the GMT website and sign up for the P500. It's, I think it's really going to be worthwhile. It's kind of a hard game to describe. It looks a little bit like Upfront. It's a bit like Point Blank from Lock and Load, if you've seen that. But the dice placement in this game is the key. It's the engine of the game. So I guess it's a bit like Table Battles from Hollenspiel in a way, but a fair bit more detailed. I'm really looking forward to it. Parting shots. Well, hats off to the moderators of all the online forums we use as gamers. BGG, Consim World, Facebook, Discord, whatever. Being a moderator is a thankless job, much like being a referee or an umpire. I know there's a fair number of folks in our hobby who'd rather live in a world that had no moderation online, no rules, no guardrails. And they feel like the participants will sort it out, everybody's an adult, so let the chips fall where they may, right? I'd say that works in real life, but it doesn't seem to be the case online. In the absence of moderation, the most virulent and loudest viewpoint is usually the last one standing. Folks with opposing viewpoints tend to leave because they don't want to argue with someone so impolite and loud, or don't want to wrestle with a pig. Or they do argue, but they never get anywhere. There's no agreement, no consensus, no concessions. The end result is fewer and fewer people attend that particular online space, other than those who agree with the dude who's so rude and shouty in the first place. So, here's to the moderators. May they tolerate everyone except the intolerant. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, drop by the website. I've got a donation link if you're feeling flush, and a ton of content whether you chip in or not. No big deal. I hope to see you there. I should also say, particularly for those who are listening, I'm trying a new experiment with this episode, and we're videoing it as well. So I should say thanks for listening or watching, or both. Anyway, catch you next time.